Welcome to the VoxGig Developer Relations Podcast. I'm your host, Richard Roger. I speak to people in the software development community about developer relations, public speaking, and community events. I'm the CEO of VoxGig, a software consultancy that builds DevRel tools. Because we believe in the power of community, we host a monthly virtual online meetup for everyone in developer relations. Check out devrelmeetup.com. And visit voxgig.com to view our work, use our tools, and sign up for our newsletter. Okay. Please sit back and enjoy my fireside chat with today's guest. So you've got yourself an API. Well, isn't that great? Here's the problem. What developers really want is an SDK. Today, I'm talking to Nolan Sullivan about why SDKs are the right way for developers to interact with your API. All right, let's get into it. Nolan, welcome. It's great to have you here on the Fireside VoxGig podcast. How is London this morning? Is it raining?
Not raining, but very excessively misting, I would say.
yes, with the forecast for more rain, no doubt. Given that I live in Ireland, I shouldn't complain too much because the southeast of England, where I did live for a little while, is definitely a lot sunnier than anywhere else in these islands. So, we are talking about developer relations and in particular, your company Speakeasy. So first I'm going to ask you to introduce yourself and then tell us a little bit about what Speakeasy does.
Sure. My name is Nolan Sullivan. I work as Speakeasy's sole developer relations person right now. Although the team is growing. So if you have any interest in after you hear this conversation, feel free to reach out to me. And Speakeasy is a company that's focused on making it easy for any API to be created and consumed. We've started on the consumption end and we've built a platform for code generation that can create SDKs, can create Terraform providers, can create documentation for your API. But in the long term, we hope to create a full tool chain for building and consuming REST APIs.
So what do you generate the code from? Is it like a Swagger spec or OpenAPI spec or what?
Yep. OpenAPI spec or Swagger, if you prefer to call it that. We'll parse that, break it down into components, and then use that as the basis for doing generation of the libraries.
Presumably, one of the key problems you're solving is the fact that if we're a Node shop or a Python shop, we've built an API, we don't know Go, we don't know C++, whatever, right? Rust. So you guys will help us generate SDKs across a wide range of languages.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think, at the very core of the problem that we're trying to solve is making it easy for people to bring their API to market. And, the developer community has never been as diverse as it is now in terms of the number of languages that are in use across companies. And it's not really realistic for people to be able to build SDKs and maintain them in all the different languages that their user base exists in. So yeah, if you're a Node shop, we can help you. We can help you with the TypeScript SDK, but we can also do, Go, Java, Python, Ruby, et cetera. So all the things that you're not familiar with.
That's an interesting point about the diversity, actually, because I've been coding since the 90s, right? The ecosystem really ended up focusing, especially on web end things, around Java for a while, and then .NET came out. But for a long while, you're a Java shop, you're a .NET shop, and there wasn't a huge amount else, especially in enterprise. There was a sort of fan club around Ruby, but that was mostly startups, right? But when I saw that change was when Node came along, and then you saw adoption of Node by Walmart and PayPal and people like that in the early sub 2010s. And now we have Rust. It just seems to be much more acceptable these days that things are written in such a wide variety. I mean, is there any, socio-ethnographic reason for that, do you think? Or Does weird shit just happen? Why is it so diverse these days?
That is a great question. I'm sure there's like some kind of programming archaeologist or anthropologist who can give a better answer to this. But like from my standpoint, it feels like, I guess it's like the same thing that's happening just at the world at large. Like it feels like people are fragmenting into smaller and smaller groups, and where, you know, you once had things that were more mainstream, like, I don't know, people watching the same TV shows, people reading the same books, or, you know, whatever it may be. But now it feels like there's further and further fragmentation, and it seems like the same thing is happening in terms of the tools people use for building. And I think maybe it's just that it's easier to build languages than it used to be. And, you know, that democratized access just means that, you know, 1,000 flowers can bloom, and some of those flowers are really tailored made for specific use cases. And if that meets what you need, then there's no reason really not to use it. I don't know.
Yeah. No, that is a really good point, right? It's actually part of a wider social change. And it's totally true, because I live in the Node universe, right? That means most of the people I follow on X Twitter, as I think it's called these days, or wherever else, most of the conferences I go to, they're all kind of Node focused.
Yeah, but even in the TypeScript ecosystem, right? Like, yeah. I mean, even in TypeScript or JavaScript, you're seeing that now there's, you know, there's Bun, there's Dino, like there are
new frameworks that are rising.
Yeah, exactly. Fragmentations within the fragment.
Yeah. Okay, let's switch gears a little bit, because I did want to dive a little bit into the technical side, if you don't mind. I know you can't code, so I don't mean to put you on the spot. I'm interested in the code generation side of things. My very first open source project, this is going back 20 years, was a code generator, template based code generator. So what approach do you guys take? Right? Do you generate from templates? Do you construct abstract syntax trees instead? Like, it's a long-standing problem, right? Code generation, but it's core to your business. Do you guys have any interesting approaches there, or is it just, you know, slog it all out? It's just lots
of code. So, yeah, I will. I'll send you a link, and maybe we can put it in show notes or something. But
sure.
Our lead engineer who kind of built the code generator gave a little talk recently on roughly how it's built. That might be interesting to people. Yeah, but the basics are that, so we start with an open API spec. We break that down into an AST. And then from there, we, like, the code generation system itself, it's built in Go, and it uses a templating system. And each language target that we support has its own template. And so the AST is fed into that, and then kind of out comes the end result. I guess one interesting thing is that we've built our own kind of templating system, which we call Easy Template. And what it does, or it's an extension on Go's templating system, but the difference is that it lets you insert arbitrary TypeScript code into the templates, just to make it a little bit more powerful. Yeah. And the reason why we went with TypeScript was just because it's just a more widely understood language. And for the different languages that we generate, we oftentimes will work with language experts who have like a spike in a specific language, like it could be Ruby, it could be PHP, whatever. And yeah, having the templates be TypeScript based just allows more people to contribute to the generation system.
Oh, okay. So do you take it to the next level? So if I use the Speakeasy service to create my SDKs, could I customize the templates with TypeScript? Is that part of
Great question.
Okay.
Not today. It's definitely something that we've always talked about, and that was part of the reason why we went with something that would hopefully be a little bit more user friendly. So it's definitely something that we've kind of have in mind. We are about to roll out a feature along these lines. It's not editing the template directly, but it's basically letting people inject custom code into their SDKs. We're calling it SDK hooks. So it's like at certain points in an SDK's execution, like say when someone's constructed a request and they're about to send it, you can actually write like a custom bit of code to take some sort of action. Like maybe you want to add logging or something and you want to log the request before it gets sent. You can just inject that into the SDK itself at runtime.
Yeah, and the reason I'm asking that question is having built a code generation system itself, you begin to realize the importance of get out of jail hooks, right? Where you can never predict in advance all the different weird edge cases you're going to hit. So you've always got to provide some capability to, as you say, inject custom code in various ways.
Yeah,
it's one of those things that people think is easy. It's not easy. Especially when you're
definitely,
doing it
for
users, right? How did Speakeasy come about? What was the genesis of the company? And how did you end up working there?
Yeah, good question. So it started off, so one of our co-founders, Sagar, so we actually had worked at the same company previous to Speakeasy. And after we had worked together, Sagar went to work on an API platform effort that Speakeasy was doing. We were trying to create like a, you know, launch an entire enterprise API for our users. I'm sure there's a lot of people that have been through similar experiences. And basically, Speakeasy came about because Sagar just could not believe like how difficult it was to do this API platform effort and how little tooling there was available off the shelf to help. Like outside of documentation providers, which is, you know, that's at like the very end of the process. There's not a lot of tooling that exists to help you build an enterprise grade REST API. And I think there's, you know, I think there's a lot of reasons for that. But, you know, when you compare it to other paradigms like GraphQL or gRPC, like those have much richer tooling ecosystems, which is crazy because REST is like 85% of all APIs are REST APIs.
I know.
And there's just no tooling that exists to help people build them. So that was really the inspiration. It was like, why is this so hard? Like, it shouldn't be this hard. Like, someone needs to build the tool chain that makes this easy.
Yeah, and it is hard. I mean, I think this gets to something we talked about just before we came on, which was, why do you need an SDK in the first place? Surely a REST API is enough, right? Just make some HTTP calls and off I go. Why do I need an SDK?
Yeah, I think it again kind of goes back to the experience at LiveRamp, which was, you know, a lot of effort went into building this API platform. Like it took, I probably took like a year to 18 months, and it was ready to go. And then there was just this experience of like, the API platform is launched and the people who were like, yeah, like we can't wait to integrate. Suddenly it's like, where are they? You know, like all these people that wanted it, like why have they not integrated? And I think the answer is like, you know, building an API is not enough. Like it's not a case of if you build it, they will come. You need to make the actual integration experience something delightful and something that people want to do. If it's a drag, if they're looking at it like, all right, there's all this stuff I need to build. I need to, you know, authentication, pagination, like I need to, you know, make sure I'm constructing the request and response objects correctly. And it's just like, if it's a pain for the developer to do, like they're not going to want to do it. And I think on the flip side, if you have SDKs, if you're abstracting a lot of the painful things about integration away from your users, then I think that building the API integration becomes something that's fairly easy for them. And ideally you want to be like that thing on people's to-do list that's just like, right, I know I can do this. This is going to be easy. I'm just going to check this off the list. Whereas it's like, if it's the thing that people are dreading, then like they're never going to find time to do it. And yeah, I think that was the experience.
It's a, like doing an actual API integration is a cost, right? It's non-trivial. I'm already paying you for to use your API in some way, right? I already signed up. You know, sure, it's costing me money. And now I have to spend developer time, which is super expensive, building, you know, by hand an integration, which is going to be buggy.
Yeah.
I mean, I've done that myself, right, for clients. You go to the documentation for one provider, and there's an SDK and code samples, and you cut and paste them. Happy days. You go to another one, and they give you curl commands. And yeah. You're like, ah, lads, come on, right? This took like 2 hours of work and turned it into a week, right?
Exactly. I think like a lot of people talk about time to 200 as being a metric that's super important, which is like, how quickly can you get people?
That's really cool. I didn't hear that one before. Time to 200. I like it. Okay.
Yeah, time to 200 is basically a metric that says like, how quickly can you get people their first successful API request? And it's definitely a really important metric. Yeah, it's an important metric, but I think people have been maybe a bit lazy with it. Like they'll oftentimes have like a button on the docs page that says like send a curl request. And they're like, all right, we're getting good time to 200 because like we've got people, you know, seeing that the API works. And it's definitely important, but like you got to take it further, because what's most important is how quickly can someone get to that 200, like in a production use case, like not just testing and playing with the API, but like actually using it in their production code base. And that's where the SDK is super critical.
So a follow-on question to that is, okay, I've got my 200 and, you know, things are starting to work. I've deployed it to dev or staging. Do you guys address the issue of testing? So this challenge is, you know, I have a dependency on an API in my code, calling it by an SDK, let's say. But in my unit tests, I don't really want to be making outbound network requests. I do want to do that on integration testing. Is it early days, or have you guys thought about that issue, how you deal with that one?
Yeah. So I, a couple thoughts on that. I think you're framing it from the standpoint of the API consumer who's like, yes, I built this integration, I want to make sure it works. Definitely something that we're thinking about longer term. But today, most of our stuff is focused on providing tooling to the API producer, like the person who's building the API. But in that respect, like we have started to see this really interesting, like emergent behavior, which is that people are building the SDKs, and the goal of building the SDK is to give a good experience to their user. But as when they build the SDK, oftentimes they start discovering, they actually start using their own API for the first time. I think because I think because a lot of people didn't want to like actually do the integration.
Oh yeah.
I know. And as part of that, they discover that actually there's all this stuff in their documentation that's incorrect, or places where the API is broken. And we've actually seen some of our users, they use the SDK to build integration test suites for their own API. So it's like by having the SDK, suddenly it becomes easier to start building that like robust testing. So there's definitely something there, and it's something we're planning to explore a lot more.
Yeah. If you guys do build that, and they get, I mean, by building API consumer, better API consumer developer experience, you are servicing the developer, the API producers, your primary customers. I would just love it if that was considered like basic best practice, is that I want to do my unit testing, calling some SDK, and I want to debug true switch or whatever, and it just gives me mock results. Okay,
definitely.
You know, maybe I have to install like a supporting package or something. Fine, that's cool. But I couldn't even tell you a single I couldn't tell you a single SDK or API that I've used that does that. And I'm not I'm not talking about sandboxes for Stripe or something like that, because that's still network requests, right? That's unit tests don't make network requests.
I mean, one thing that we've seen is, like, so our TypeScript SDK in particular, one thing that it has is that it has type safety on both the request and the response objects. And it actually enforces that, like, the response that the API is sending is the response that's expected. So the consumer kind of gets that baked in. Like, if the API isn't respecting its own contract, our SDK will fail and say, hey, the API has violated, you know, what the written response is supposed to look like. And that's actually, again, that's, like, helped the API producers that we work with fix all of these issues that exist in their API, your users can really easily point it out and be like, yeah, this you know, this is failing type check.
Yeah. And it's terrible how prevalent that issue is, right? Where it's like, oh, here's your JSON document back or whatever. It's like, oh, this is a load of extra fields that they aren't spec'd. Yeah, I mean,
it's hard to blame people, because I think the tooling has been lacking.
Right, and so this comes back to...
We're only as good as the tools that are available to us.
Yeah, it comes back to the motivation for Speakeasy, right? Which is the tooling is terrible, right? The tooling is terrible. Yeah. It's 2024, it's kind of crazy. I was speaking to another guest recently who was telling me there's 200 million APIs.
Wow. Right? Yeah, it's crazy.
All built without... fundamental tooling, all built pretty much as custom handcrafted APIs.
Yeah, it's wild, right?
Yeah, it's fun out there. It's fun out there, people. How did you end up in developer relations? Because you're in the classic developer relations role in a startup where it's just you. I know you guys are expanding and you're going to hire, but right now, how many hats do you wear?
I mean, I guess I've worn a lot of hats at different times. I was doing customer onboarding for a while until we've recently hired someone to handle, like, a customer success or developer success, as we call it. You know, I do the more traditional marketing stuff as well, because we don't have a separate marketing team. And then, more of the traditional developer advocate kind of activities. So those are probably the main one.
It's interesting, isn't it? People often ask, what are the key hires in an early stage startup? You know what? Developer advocate is probably one of the people you should hire in the first five, right? Because as you just said, right, you're like a one-person marketing team, one-person customer success team, right? I bet you've written documentation, all sorts of stuff, right? Hire developer advocates, folks, and there's lots of them out there at the moment, right? With all these layoffs, there's actually really good people out there.
I mean, it obviously depends on, you know, your business and what your model is going to be, but I definitely think that having some, I mean, if you're selling to developers, then I kind of think that, you know, marketing, developer advocacy, like, they're almost one in the same, you know, like, in the sense that marketing is the dissemination of that's useful to your target audience, then, you know, like, a good marketing team should be pretty similar to, like, a developer advocate team in a lot of ways.
Do you feel that you found, Nolan, do you feel you found your kind of place in the tech ecosystem now? I know you were doing kind of product management before, that sort of stuff, and you ended up in developer relations. Does it feel like the right fit for you?
Yeah. That's a good question. I don't know. I think it depends a lot probably on the company. I think that's one thing, like, and I'll be honest, like, I don't, when people ask me about developer advocacy, like, I have one experience, and that's it. Like, I've not worked in developer advocacy for 10 years. I don't really have, like, a lot of data points to draw over. But from looking around, it seems like what a developer advocate is depends a lot on the company. right? It's like one of those things. It can change completely. And you know, my background is as a PM, and I actually think that product is very similar. What a product manager is can vary wildly, like depending upon the company. I do think that, like at Speakeasy, I love my role in developer relations. Like, I've always been a generalist, and I think that I have an opportunity to contribute in a lot of different ways. Like, you know, the being able to write, being able to work with our developer team. Like, I'm one of the heaviest users of our product, so I get to provide, you know, feedback and guidance, and I get to interview users, which, you know, maybe are more traditionally like product activities. But we don't have a product team. Create like visual content as well, which was something that I didn't really have experience with, but that's been fun to explore, and dabbling in Figma and all this different stuff. So yeah, I like the fact that, to do the job, it requires a lot of different skills across a variety of disciplines. Yeah. And that's been something I really enjoy.
Yeah, that is the awesome part about this job, right? For a generalist, it's fantastic. Do you plan to do any or have you done any speaking at conferences, that type of stuff? That's also one of the things people end up doing.
I have. I've spoken at a few. I've done a few of the API Days conferences. I did Nordic APIs in Stockholm. And I think there's a bunch coming up this year. But yeah, that's been really good. I didn't have a lot of experience speaking at conferences before doing this role.
Yeah.
It's been really fun to kind of explore. I wouldn't say public speaking is something that I was particularly excited about, but I actually think that now I view it as an opportunity to meet people. And sometimes you get to see like the same people at some of the conferences, and it's, yeah, nice to build those relationships and meet interesting people.
Yeah, the best parts of doing a talk is people come up to talk to you afterwards, right?
Yeah,
that's often exactly. the best part. Public speaking is always fun. When you guys are a bit further along and have the cash to spare, get a speaking coach. They are they make a huge difference. They really do. There's a whole set of tricks and tips and skills to it and all that sort of stuff. Nolan, we've kind of come to the end. It sounds like you're kind of set up for a really cool, fun career in developer relations. And Speakeasy is definitely solving a problem that I've personally had. So I'm delighted to speak to you guys. Super interesting to hear about all the ways you're doing code generation as well. May 2024 be incredibly prosperous for you guys. Go out there and solve some real problems. Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much. Thanks for having me. Thanks for, you know, creating something that for the developer relations community.
Awesome. Alrighty, take care. Bye-bye.
All right, bye.
You can find the transcript of this podcast and any links mentioned on the podcast section of our website, voxgig.com/podcast. Subscribe to the VoxGig Developer Relations Podcast on Apple, Spotify, or any podcasting platform. We publish each Tuesday and Thursday. You can also access the archive of our meetup talks on the VoxGig YouTube channel or the VoxGig website. Thanks for listening. Catch you next time.